this week on the College Football Roundup. Is the Lane train leaving Oxford? The Trojans disappoint again. Virginia Tech has a new coach and so much more. This is the Monday Report, starting now. All right. Hello, everybody. It is Monday, November 24th, 2025, and this is the Monday Report. I'm your host, H. James K., and today we have got a packed show for you. So, right off the top, we're going to talk about James Franklin. So, last Monday, in the middle of the afternoon, Virginia Tech announced that they had hired their next football coach. James Franklin, he is joining the Hokies on a five-year, $41.75 million deal, paying him $8.3 million per year. I could have made an emergency episode about this on Monday, but I was tired, and I was working on my book, and I chose not to. But we are absolutely going to talk about it here. So, this is a great signing for a multitude of reasons. So, right off the top, James Franklin has ties to the Virginia area. I'm not particularly sure what those ties are, to be honest with you, but I do know he has deep relationships with a lot of the high schools in the area. He recruited Virginia heavily while at Penn State. So from that perspective, he's already got a bit of a foundation in place to help Virginia Tech's recruiting. Another aspect of this that I think is kind of underrated is people view James Franklin as this loser who always fell short, and you know, he was, you know, Mr. 10-2, couldn't get over the hump, blah 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 blah. But people need to understand that he was in the Big Ten, for crying out loud. It's the Big Ten Conference. It's the hardest, most difficult, most talented conference in football. And yes, I do believe the conference is more talented than the SEC. I believe that. It's the best conference. And it's really hard to win the conference when every year you've got to deal with Oregon, Ohio State, and Michigan. Especially recently. So, for him, he was always running into teams that were better than him. Because he has a bit of a hard ceiling. But at Virginia Tech, he won't have those issues. Yes, Miami, Florida State, maybe, you know, Virginia, Syracuse, SMU. There are good teams in the ACC. Have no, don't doubt that. But it is not the Big Ten. It's not the SEC. So for him, his skill level should land Virginia Tech in the hunt for the conference championship every year. Which means Virginia Tech should be continually contending for a playoff berth in the ACC, which would be awesome. Excuse me, sorry. So, I think while Franklin's ceiling was limited in the Big Ten, I think the sky is the limit for what he can do at Virginia Tech. Because people forget that Virginia Tech was an East Coast power for a long time under legendary head coach Frank Beamer. I mean, the dude was a standard. He was like forever at Virginia Tech. I mean, Beamer ball, it was its own thing. And they've lost that since Frank Beamer retired years ago, and I genuinely believe James Franklin can kind of bring them back to that, because he's a quality coach who's going to be able to hit the ground running. He has a clear idea of what he needs to do, and one thing that's really important, the Virginia Tech administration has promised more investment, more money, more resources for the football team to help the football team be competitive. Because as we're seeing, if you're not willing to pay the money and have a high payroll, like near $25 million, your roster is not going to be talented enough to compete. You just won't. Michigan, Ohio State, Bama, Georgia, you know, Texas, Oklahoma, those teams have really big payrolls. And if you're not serious about it, you know, teams like Rutgers, Purdue, Michigan State, Duke, Kentucky, you're never going to be a contender. And I think Virginia Tech wants to be a contender again, especially in the ACC. I mean, right now, the ACC's contenders are Virginia, Georgia Tech, and Southern Methodist University. Not exactly titans of major college football. And yet, those are the top dogs, which means this conference is ripe for the picking. It's right there to be taken. And even before Franklin has stepped on the field for a game for the first time, I am going to stake a claim right now. Virginia Tech will be in the ACC championship by 2027. Within 2 years, I think he's going to have the program turned around in the right direction and scratching and clawing for an ACC title. Because if he goes 8-4 or 9-3 with the right combination of wins and losses, he can get in with tiebreakers. I mean, we're going to talk about conference title game scenarios later on in the show, so we'll get into that. But the ACC is wide open this year, just like it was wide open last year. And as long as Clemson is not going to be, you know, sucking up all the oxygen, I think it's going to stay that way. So I love this hire. I'm happy for James Franklin. And compared to what's going on at Penn State right now, where there still really hasn't been any word on a coach, and you know their recruiting class has just collapsed. Like 18 of their players in their high school recruiting class have decommitted and gone elsewhere. It's the most in the country. It's a calamity. So in comparison, I think Virginia Tech and James Franklin, because they signed him last Monday and they got this all together now, he can be on campus putting together a staff and recruiting the current roster and figuring out what he's going to do ahead of the single transfer portal window in January. And because Virginia Tech ain't in the playoffs this year, they're going to be very active while the playoffs are going on. So I love it. I love it. I love it. I love it. All right, for the rest of the show, we're going to talk about Lane Kiffin rumors, obviously. We're going to talk about Oregon versus USC, Oklahoma versus Mizzou, Pitt versus Georgia Tech. We're going to go over the Michigan versus Maryland game. I'll talk about conference title scenarios. We'll do quick hits and then previews of next week's games, including Michigan versus Ohio State. Alabama versus Auburn, Texas A&M versus Texas, Ole Miss, Mississippi State, and Georgia versus Georgia Tech. That's what we got. So moving on to the Lane train. So there are rumors that LSU is putting together a $90 million offer. $90 million. Rumors are it would pay somewhere in the neighborhood of $13 million a year. So yeah, they're serious. And, it would be like a roughly 7-year, $13 million a year kind of offer. And that kind of money is hard to pass up. Like, personally, I think Lane Kiffin should stay in Oxford. I think he can win a championship in Oxford. I think he's got a good thing going. But he's going to leave. He's going to go be the LSU head coach. We haven't gotten the official confirmation about that, but I expect some after the Egg Bowl. That is this Saturday's Ole Miss versus Mississippi State matchup. I expect he's going to announce that he will be leaving after the season for LSU. After Ole Miss has done their playoff run, he'll be saying, yeah, he'll be leaving for LSU. So I think that is definitely coming. God, it's such a mistake, though. It's such a mistake. But at the same time, this is what Lane Kiffin does. It is in his nature. He moves around a lot. It was Tennessee, then it was the Oakland Raiders, then it was USC, and then they fired him, and then he went to Bama for a while, but then it was you know, Florida Atlantic, and he was there for like 2 years. And then he's been at, you know, Ole Miss for like 4 or 5 years now, and now he's going to move on to LSU. And I guarantee you in 4 or 5 years, he's going to move on from LSU when Florida invariably fires the next head coach they hire, and he'll be going to Florida. And then, you know, in you know, in 2036, he'll get tired of coaching at Florida and he'll move somewhere else because it's just, it's in his nature. It's what he does. He'll give you like 5 solid years, then he's out. Assuming he doesn't get fired. So, I don't like it. I think it's unfair to the players and at Ole Miss and the fans and the administration to keep them in the lurch because it's a circus right now. Florida, and it's like you're married and your wife, there are rumors your wife is sleeping with 2 other men. You ask her about it. She won't confirm or deny. You know it's true, but she won't tell you, so you really can't do anything about it. You can't divorce her. You can't make up with her. You just kind of have to live in that limbo forever and ever and ever until she gets off her ass and tells the truth. Lane Kiffin's doing that same thing because he loves the attention. He's a little shitster. He loves media attention. So for him, this is just like, great. This is just stroking his ego. Even though he's jerking around Ole Miss and he's screwing over their players and being horribly unfair to their fans, but that's Lane Kiffin for you. Admittedly, I've lost a lot of respect for the man for this whole saga because as a Michigan fan, I went through this with Jim Harbaugh 3 separate times in 21, 22, and 23, and he left in 23, but it was like you spent that 3 weeks going, yeah, he ain't going to leave, telling yourself he ain't going to leave, even as you're reading reports of him interviewing with the Chicago Bears or the Minnesota Vikings or the LA Chargers. And you're like, oh, he ain't going to leave. Oh, see, you guys are being idiots. There's no way he's going to leave. Why would he leave Michigan? It's his alma mater. Blah, 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 blah. And you're just kind of in that limbo as everyone makes jokes about how, oh, yeah, he gone. It's just, it's unfair. It's not, it's unfair to fans. And if Lane is leaving, he should just fucking say it, dude. Just go say, yeah, after the season's over, I'm leaving Ole Miss to go to LSU to be their new head coach. After the playoffs. That's all you got to do. End this whole drama. I mean, he's already going to make more per year than any coach in the history of football. He'll be higher paid than anyone in the NFL, I'm pretty sure. So, I don't like it, but it is what it is. All right, let's talk about some games. First up, the number 7 Oregon Ducks defeated the number 15 USC Trojans. The Ducks won 42-27. Ducks quarterback Dante Moore finished the day 22 of 30 passing for 257 yards, 2 touchdowns, and 1 interception. He also had 2 carries for -3 yards. USC QB Jaden Maiava finished the day 25 of 43 for 306 yards with 3 passing touchdowns and 2 interceptions. He also had 4 carries for 16 yards. So, this game is interesting because this game took place in the LA Coliseum in a driving rainstorm. They had like an entire weekend's worth of rain. So this was a very Big Ten West kind of game. Slippery, messy, and ugly game. And Oregon was just better. They were just better. But at the same time, the game was very close for a long, long time. Very much a back-and-forth affair, very physical. And then, late in the game, Oregon remembered, oh yeah, we got a win today. And they just pulled away and won. Buried him. Buried him under special teams mistakes, defensive lapses, and the lack of a consistent running game. I mean, it wasn't for a lack of trying on USC's part, because like wide receiver Mekhi Lemon threw a 24-yard touchdown to Tanuke Hines, and he caught 2 of them on his own. So, and that, by the way, that throw to Tanuke Hines was incredible. Not only was it an absolute seed, but Tanuke Hines had an incredible catch that where he had to like go up and high point it and come down and contort himself to get the ball over the line into the end zone. It was impressive. So, at the end of the day, the same issues plagued USC as they always seem to under Lincoln Riley. Penalties, turnovers, mental errors, lack of physicality. Same shit, different day. Same old story. The special teams errors in particular were inexcusable. Just, it's the kind of thing where high quality championship caliber football teams don't make continual special teams errors. Blocked punts, missed field goals, errors on returns, penalties galore. It's the kind of thing that is a result of poor coaching. And Lincoln Riley is a good offensive mind, but he's not a good coach. He's just not. He's not cut out for major Power 4 Big Ten football. Because while he has, quote, made a commitment to being more physical and having a better defense, at the end of the day, culture is a reflection of the coach. That's what culture is. Under Jim Harbaugh, it was, we are going to physically dominate you and be perfect. You are going to make the mistake, not us. We're going to dominate you and smother you and drown you under a mountain, a mountain of excellent execution. For Lincoln Riley's USC teams, it's just, we're going to throw the ball a lot. We're going to play okay defense. We're going to run the ball on the teams that are bad. And when it really counts, we're not going to be able to run the ball. Oh, and we're going to commit back-breaking special teams errors and way too many penalties. That's USC football. And it shouldn't be this way. This is USC. They should be a powerhouse. They are the kings of the West Coast. And yet, they're just another team in the Big Ten, falling short yet again. This eliminates USC from playoff and Big Ten championship contention outright. They're done. Bye-bye. It just, it is what it is. So, it helps Oregon. It helps Oregon. It doesn't help or hurt Michigan. It does get a team with a tiebreaker over Michigan out of the way. But for USC, it's yet another season of disappointing results where the team was more than talented enough to succeed and had tons of NFL starters and yet fell short for the same reasons as always. And while I'm not calling for Lincoln Riley to be fired or anything, people need to realize this is what USC is going to be under him. You're never going to win the Big Ten. You're never going to go to the playoffs. You're never going to win a championship because it's just not, he's not cut out for that kind of level of success at USC. He's just not. He'd be great in the Big 12 where you don't have to be super physical and super perfect at all times. Or the ACC where you can oops your way into a conference championship game. You can't do that in the Big Ten. In the Big Ten, you have to be perfect. And even then, you have to hope that other teams cannibalize themselves around you to clear the way to allow you to succeed. That's the Big Ten. Otherwise, James Franklin would have gone to a big, you know, would have won the Big Ten. But he didn't. And if James Franklin couldn't do it, then sure as hell Lincoln Riley ain't going to do it. So for Oregon, huge. Keeps their playoff hopes and Big Ten championship hopes alive. We'll talk more about those conference scenarios later, but this was a big one for them. They needed this one because if you lose to USC, not only does it keep USC's playoff hopes, it almost guarantees they go to the playoffs. Or at least it would almost guarantee they were in the conversation, but it would have eliminated the Ducks from playoff contention completely. And they're too talented and too well coached for that. So the Ducks won. Now, next week, they will play Washington for, I forget what that game has a name, but I don't remember what it was called. Either way, it's a rivalry. They hate each other, and that's going to be a fun game to watch. Moving on to number 8, Oklahoma took down number 22, Mizzou. The score was 17-6, and this game was ugly. Oh my god, it was so bad. This was, if there was ever a Brent Venables game, it was this one. John Mateer, Oklahoma's quarterback, finished 14 of 30 for 173 yards, 2 touchdowns. He also had 18 carries for 60 yards. He's clearly not 100% healthy, but at the same time, the offense, as called by Ben Arbuckle, and as constructed by Brent Venables just isn't good. They're just ugly. Not fun to watch. There's no rhyme or reason. There's no flow. There's no cadence to the offense. It's just kind of, do that play. We'll call that play this time. And part of that is, I think, is Ben Arbuckle, because Ben Arbuckle, when he was at Wazoo, at Washington State with John Mateer, his offense was great against teams that didn't matter, but teams with a solid defense, his offense was never good. John Mateer's passing efficiency would drop precipitously against quality defenses when he was at Washington State. So it's one of those where you hoped for better, but I can't be super surprised. And, I mean, these Brent Venables Oklahoma teams have not had a good offense. None of them have had an elite offense. It's been scratching and clawing for anything on offense every single time. So that doesn't surprise me. Now, on the Mizzou side, they got starting quarterback Bo Prabula back. Now, Bo Prabula, for those who don't know, was Drew Aller's backup at Penn State last year, and he transferred to Mizzou this season. He's a running quarterback by nature. He finished the day 20 of 36 for 231 yards and 2 interceptions. He also had 8 carries for 1 yard. It was clear from the onset that Bo Prabula was not healthy. I think it was like an ankle sprain or a high ankle sprain or some kind of sprain or something that he had missed like the last 2 games. And it was very clear he wasn't healthy because Mizzou wants to run the ball, dominate the time of possession, and play defense. And they just couldn't run the ball against Oklahoma. And part of that is Brent Venables' defenses are just ridiculous. But it was watching the game, Bo Prabula wasn't healthy. Nothing looked right. It looked like everything he did took effort. So it was an ugly win, but It was ugly. God, I couldn't watch it. It was really boring. I changed the channel. I watched a different game in that time slot. What else to talk about with this game? Because this could have been an email. You know, it's like we all kind of knew this game was going to play out this way because of their defense, because of the Sooners' defense and their significantly healthier yet still unhealthy quarterback and the talent level and everything, but boring, ugly, uninspiring ball. Oklahoma is going to limp into the playoffs. You know, they're not, I wouldn't consider them a contender, but they're definitely going on the back of their inconsistent offense and smothering defense. That defense is ridiculous. It's so good. But this is a tough season for Mizzou. This is a tough way for the season to end because they get off to a wonderful start. They were like, oh gosh, like 8-1, somewhere in there, something like that. And then Bo Prabula got hurt, and it's kind of like, what, you know, the wagon wheels have come off. And they're going to miss out on SEC title contention and playoff contention, and it's like, cool, go enjoy your mid-tier bowl game. Because that's what Mizzou's going to get. I had to take a drink of water to preserve my voice. All right, moving on. Pitt. The Pitt Panthers upset the number 16 Georgia Tech Yellow Jackets. Boy, this is a game I thought Pitt was going to get blasted by Georgia Tech. And in the end, Pitt defeated the Yellow Jackets in Atlanta 42-28. And this game was never in doubt. It was never close. True freshman QB Mason Heinschel for Pitt finished the game 20 of 27 for 226 yards, 2 touchdowns, 10 carries for negative 29 yards, and a rushing touchdown. This kid was the third string QB on the depth chart to start the year, and Pitt head coach Pat Narduzzi just went to him during a loss, and this Mason Heinschel kid is really good. He's got ice in his veins. He's got a good arm. He's athletic. He can run around. He's going to be in the portal playing for someone else next year. you know, he might stick around at Pitt, but he's really good. I would not be surprised if he's playing for a major player next year. On the Georgia Tech side, Georgia Tech quarterback Haynes King went 27 of 41 for 257 yards, two touchdowns, and two interceptions. He also had 20 carries on the ground for 76 yards and a touchdown. So here's what there is to know about Haynes King. So Haynes King played for Texas A&M originally. He committed to them under Jimbo Fisher, but he jumped in the portal when that whole thing kind of fell apart. And he's been at Georgia Tech, and he is a quarterback that has to have 20 carries for over 100 yards rushing to be effective. It is a fundamental part of his game. He always runs the ball way too much for a quarterback, and he is incapable of being a standard throw the ball only quarterback. He's just not capable of it. I'm going to look up his stat line right now. Let's look at his season stats and see if we can't see how often he needs to get 100 plus yards rushing. So the Pitt head coach Pat Narduzzi, before the Notre Dame game last weekend, he said that, you know, that game didn't matter. It didn't matter if they got blown out, and then they got blown out. The only games that mattered were conference games like this Georgia Tech game, and everyone was kind of wondering if Georgia Tech was going to beat the crap out of them. And, you know, if that would kind of put Pat Narduzzi on the hot seat. But instead, Pitt just contained Haynes King's run ability and caused some turnovers and just really jumped out on Georgia Tech immediately. All right, let's look at his stats. All right, so after 5 minutes of research, Haynes King had 100 rushing yards or more in 5 of his 10 starts, and he had 91 yards rushing in another start. In both losses this season, he was held to 76 or fewer. And in one loss, it was 53 yards rushing. When teams contain Haynes King and the Georgia Tech rushing attack, it's incredibly hard for Georgia Tech's offense to function. So Pitt knew the assignment. They knew that Haynes King was going to get his yards, but it was more important to slow down his rushing attack and not let him run wild and cause havoc. So the game actually played out. It was insane. So Pitt raced out to a 28-0 lead before halftime. It was like 21-0 at the end of the first quarter or something like that. The game went to halftime 28-14. In the third quarter, a 10-play, 75-yard Georgia Tech drive ended with a back-breaking 100-yard interception return for a touchdown that happened at the goal line. That made it 35-14. Two touchdowns in the fourth helped Georgia Tech pull within a score, but another long run by Pitt ultimately put the game out of reach, ending the score 42-28. So this doesn't completely eliminate Georgia Tech from like playoff contention and ACC title. Their only way in is to win the ACC, but they're not technically out of it, but they're basically out of it unless they get insane amounts of help. For Pitt, this is quite the turnaround. They have a real shot at going to the ACC title game, and we'll talk about that a little bit later. But it's one of these things where 2 weeks ago, I never would have considered Pitt a contender for the ACC. And yet here we are. And if that isn't more evidence of why I think James Franklin is going to succeed at Virginia Tech, then I don't know what is. Because in that kind of environment, he's the perfect coach to succeed. All right, moving on, we got to talk about Michigan. Michigan handled Maryland. They defeated the Maryland Terrapins 45-20. Bryce Underwood went 16 of 23 for 215 yards and two touchdowns. He also had 8 carries for 20 yards. fellow true freshman and also Maryland starting QB Malik Washington went 19 of 39 for 210 yards, one touchdown, and one interception. He also had 10 carries for 16 yards. So, without question, this was Michigan's most complete game of the season. And as we saw against Northwestern, the Michigan passing attack, when it wants to, can be very explosive. Like in the first half, Michigan was like, okay, we're going to throw the ball on you all over the place. Bomb show. You know, Andrew Marsh was everywhere. Donovan McCulley, Zach Marshall, Marlon Klein got in on the action. You know, it was really, it was like 183 passing yards at halftime. And then Michigan said, you know what, we're out a couple of scores. Let's just kind of coast and avoid injuries and mistakes. And they just, that's what they did. But for Bryce Underwood, he threw a ball that should have been picked and probably should have been returned for a touchdown. It was right at a linebacker. It was really bad. But other than that single play, it was an incredible performance. He was super accurate. Once again, his throwing motion and footwork were immaculate. His ball placement is something else. He overthrew one other ball that sailed over the receiver's head and just kind of fell to the turf. But he made some throws where you're like, good Lord. Like layering them over tall linebackers in front of safeties to get the tight end. Stuff like that. It was, and he's still so fast. So, it was impressive from Bryce Underwood. It's one of those where it's like, man, if this is what he's like as a true freshman with Chip Lindsey and this cast of characters, what is he going to be like as a sophomore and a junior? Like, sophomore season Bryce Underwood, look out, Big Ten, like, possible quarterback of the year kind of stuff. So, it's, and Malik Washington, to kind of pivot to the Maryland QB, this kid is supremely talented. And he had several overthrows, back-breaking overthrows. We're like, dude, if you just put air onto that and put some touch on that, and that's a touchdown. He overthrew a literal touchdown. He had another tight end who did like an out and up on the sideline, and he just totally missed him. He had another one where he underthrew a receiver on the sideline. You're like, dude, you got to complete those. And he's a true freshman, so he'll grow into that, assuming Mike Locksley actually develops him. But he's very talented. Like, he's one of these guys who's got enough athletic gifts that if he gets proper coaching, he could be really deadly. He could be lethal. So, beyond the quarterbacks in the passing game, Michigan's injuries. So, going into the game, Justice Haynes is out for the year. And Jordan Marshall got hurt against Northwestern, and he was iffy if he could play. He dressed. He was fully suited and booted to play, but they didn't play him, which I think meant that he was probably it's overtime, we can't run the ball, we got to get a touchdown here, break glass in case of emergency kind of thing. So he didn't see the field at all. And if that wasn't enough, team captain, multi-year starting fullback Max Bredesen, who had also been taking snaps at running back to help bolster depth, he suffered a leg injury in the third quarter, and according to Sharon Moore, it looks bad. It does not look promising, which means we have likely seen the last of Ben Bredesen unless Michigan beats Ohio State and makes a deep playoff run. Maybe then we get to see him again, but I'm not, which is, it's really sad that we're not going to get to see him beat Ohio State again. You know, we're not going to let to see him play against Ohio State and do a bowl game because he's been a stalwart. He has been a constant, much like his brother Ben Bredesen was. So it was really sad. And he came out of the locker room in street clothes with crutches. It was really disappointing. And for Michigan's running game, obviously Jordan Marshall is going to be playing against Ohio State. But for the Maryland game, this left Bryson Cuzdahl and Jasper Parker as the real running backs. And Bryson Cuzdahl carried the ball 20 times for 100 yards and 3 touchdowns. Now, it is worth noting that Maryland has the 115th worst rush defense in the country, so I don't know if he'll be able to, if Bryson Kuzdal will be able to replicate that kind of performance. But all the same, he showed burst, decisiveness, vision. He was so fast. He was deceptively physical for someone who's not nearly as big as Jordan Marshall. He had a hat trick. Jasper Parker got in on it a little bit, as did Michael Kaapana. And another running back, who I had never even heard of, called Thomas O'Meara, got into it. He almost got a touchdown, but they were running out the clock at the time, so he fell short of that. Either way, the Michigan running back room is a bit of a mash unit at the moment, which doesn't bode well for Ohio State. All the same, with Michigan's O-line playing as well as they are right now, I am quietly confident that Michigan will be able to run the ball at least a little bit going forward in, you know, Ohio State, and if we make it to the championship, get into the Big Ten championship, then maybe in that game or a bowl game or whatever. From here, I do believe Michigan will be able to run the ball to a degree. Maybe not the all-seeing, all-encompassing domination that we saw in the beginning of the year, but still. What I do think this means, though, is we're going to have to rely more on the passing game to be explosive and to be consistent with, like, screens and tunnel screens and throwback screens and that kind of stuff, and play action to supplement some of the short yardage gains that Michigan may not be getting as much of, you know, with the running game being so injured. Andrew Marsh, true freshman, 6 foot tall, 191 pounds. The dude is only 6 feet tall, but he plays like a wide receiver who is 6'4". He plays very tall, very rangy. He's really fast. He is Michigan's clear-cut number one receiver. In the last two games, he has really set himself apart. He leads the team in receiving yards with like 42 catches for like 625 yards receiving and like 3 touchdowns. As a true freshman, against Northwestern, he set like the single game record for receptions by a freshman and receiving yards by a freshman in a single game. So he's just an absolute stud, and he has such an incredible catch radius, and he is so fast. So look for Bryce Underwood to look for him a lot going forward, especially if Michigan is having trouble running the ball. As for the defense, Cole Sullivan was back in the lineup, which was really nice. He has been injured since the Michigan State game. At the time, he was leading Michigan in interceptions, and Jimmy Rolder was back. Now, Samaj and Ernest Hausman did not make the trip to Maryland with the team for undisclosed reasons. The rumor is that Ernest Hausman may have been sick or going through something. Either way, we don't know why him and Samaj were not with the team. I think Samaj is probably jumping in the portal, considering he lost his starting wide receiver spot to Donovan McCauley, Andrew Marsh, and Channing Goodwin, and the passing game looks better without him. And he lost his starting gig as the punt returner to Andrew Marsh, who already is a better punt returner than he was. You know, and he's got the drops, and he kind of loafs sometimes in run blocking, so I think he might be jumping in the pro. I don't know what's going on with Hausman, though, because Hausman's a multi-year starter, all Big Ten guy. There's no way he would be, like, walking away from the team. So maybe he was sick. Either way, we'll hope to have him back for Ohio State. I thought the defense played well against Maryland. It wasn't perfect, but it was a damn good performance. It was like 42-13 forever. And then Maryland got a garbage time touchdown to make it 20. So, Michigan's most complete game. Not their most impressive game, but definitely the most complete game that Michigan has played so far. More than Central, more than, you know, a lot of the early season games in Nebraska, Northwestern, all. It was the best performance Michigan has had this year so far. Moving on to conference title game scenarios. As we did last week, I'm going to be going through the top contenders in the Big Ten, SEC, ACC, and Big 12, telling you their record, their conference record, and what they need to do to get into the playoffs. Sorry, some weird thing was going on with my computer. Distracted me for a moment. All right, starting with the Big Ten, still in first place, you got the Indiana Hoosiers. They are 11-0. 8-0 in conference, they were on a bye. All they got to do to get into the Big Ten championship game, beat Purdue. That's it. Beat Purdue. Nothing else that happens can affect how they get into the championship game as long as they beat Purdue. Just beat Purdue. Coming in second in the Big Ten, you got Ohio State, who is 11-0, 8-0 in conference. All they got to do is beat Michigan. You beat Michigan, you're in. You lose to Michigan, you're out. And you're out, period, because Michigan would have a tiebreaker over Ohio State, and even if Washington beat Oregon, Michigan would still go. So, win and you're in. Now, for Oregon, things get different. They are third in the conference. They are 10-1 overall, 7-1 in conference. So, they need a win over rival Washington, and they need Michigan to beat Ohio State in order to face Indiana in the conference championship game. It's because Indiana gave them their first loss of the season and some of the tiebreakers, so they need help. Most assuredly, they need Michigan to beat Ohio State because they would have a tiebreaker over Michigan just because they would have I think it's like the fourth level tiebreaker where it's like the cumulative win percentage of all of your conference opponents or something like that, and they have us beating that fourth level tiebreaker. So that's what Oregon needs. Now, Michigan is now currently fourth in the Big Ten after USC went down. Michigan is 9-2 overall, 7-1 in conference. They need to beat Ohio State, and they need to have Oregon or Indiana lose their last game against Washington and Purdue, respectively. If Michigan beats Ohio State and one of Oregon and Indiana lose, Michigan is going to the Big Ten championship game against whichever team didn't lose. Now, if they both lose, then I'm pretty sure it would be Indiana would go anyway over Oregon. So, that's what Michigan needs. Moving on to the SEC, Texas A&M is number one in the conference. They are 11-0, 7-0 conference. All they got to do is they got to they just beat Texas, or if Texas beats them, both Bama and Ole Miss would have to lose. But the easier path is just beat the Longhorns for the first time since like 2011 or whatever. They haven't even played each other in over a decade, so it'll be interesting. My voice is failing me. I was yelling at the Lions game on Sunday, so my voice is shot to hell. Number two in the SEC is the Georgia Bulldogs. They are 10-1, 7-1 in conference. So they need either Bama or Texas A&M to lose their final game, and the Dogs are in. That's it. If one of Bama or Texas A&M lose, the Dogs are going. No pressure. It's just, you know, you're relying on Texas and Auburn to put you in the conference championship game, but that's it. Coming in third in the SEC, you got Ole Miss. The Rebels are 10-1, 6-1 in conference. They got to beat Mississippi State, and they need Bama and Texas A&M to both lose. So in order for Ole Miss, the stars have to align for Ole Miss to get in. Interestingly enough, Alabama is fourth in the SEC rankings right now. They are 9-2 overall, 6-1 in conference. But in order for Alabama to get into the SEC championship game, all they have to do is beat Auburn. If they beat Auburn, they jump Georgia and Ole Miss in the standings to go to the SEC championship game to play Texas A&M, which blows my mind. But that's how the tiebreakers work. So if they beat Auburn, they're done. They're gone. All right, moving on to the ACC. So, strangely enough, Virginia. Yes, what are they? The Cavaliers, that's what they are. The Virginia Cavaliers. They are 9-2 overall, 6-1 in conference. their path into the championship game is beat Virginia Tech this weekend. Or have Pitt lose to Miami. That's it. That's all that's got to happen for Virginia. Now, for Pitt, they need to beat Miami. Pitt is second in the ACC, and here's how you know how wide open the ACC is. Virginia is 9-2, 6-1 in conference. Pitt is 7-3, 5-1 in conference. And they have kind of oopsie stumbled their way into the fast lane in the last, like, 3 weeks. So, Pitt needs to beat Miami, which that game is in Pittsburgh, and it's going to be cold as hell. So I think I have a feeling they're going to beat Miami. Probably. I don't know. I wrote down a prediction earlier on Sunday, but I don't remember what it was. I just looked, and sure enough, I got Pitt winning. Yeah, so Pitt's just got to beat Miami, and they need SMU or Virginia to lose. If one of those two teams loses, then the Pitt Panthers are going to the ACC Championship game, where they have a chance to do the funniest thing ever and get a three-loss team into the playoffs in the most unlikely of ways. Well, into the conference championship game, assuming they win. Third in the ACC is Southern Methodist. Yes, SMU. They are 8-3 overall. Wait a minute. I spotted a typo. I forgot to update Pitt's win total. They are 8-3 overall, 5-1 in the conference. Forgive me. That is my lack of attention to detail. I was wondering why. I was like, why do they only have 10 games on my write-up? Either way, back to SMU. So SMU, they're, as I said, they're 8-3 overall. They're 6-1 in conference. SMU, all you got to do in the affirmative direction is beat Cal. And Cal just fired head coach Justin Wilcox after 9 years. So I'm liking their chances. If they don't beat Cal, then they need Pitt to lose to Miami in Pittsburgh, when it's going to be like 20 degrees and snowy. So, SMU, beat Cal. Beat the worst team in your conference. That's all you got to do. Fourth in the ACC is Miami. The Hurricanes are 9-2 overall, 5-2 in conference. Their path is a little murkier. So, they need to beat Pitt, and either Duke has to lose to Wake Forest or Virginia Tech has to beat Virginia. They need one of those two teams to kind of fall to make sure that all of the different tiebreakers in the ACC work themselves out. I think they're going to lose to Pitt, so I think it's all kind of moot. And then lastly, fifth overall in the ACC, you got Georgia Tech. The Yellow Jackets are 9-2. They are 6-2 in conference. They need both Virginia and SMU have to lose. Both of those teams have to lose their games so that Georgia Tech can get in with a tiebreaker due to beating Wake Forest, who is a common opponent for Virginia and SMU and Georgia Tech. So, God, tiebreakers are so confusing. So, yeah, because they beat Wake Forest earlier in the year, and I guess Virginia and SMU didn't, that would be getting them in if Virginia and SMU lost. Talk about not being in your own hands. Ultimately, I think it's going to be Virginia and Pitt, which, boy, I didn't have that on my bingo card when I made my predictions back in August. Last of the conferences you got to talk about is the Big 12. So coming in first, you got Texas Tech. They are 10-1 overall, 7-1 in conference. If they beat West Virginia, they're in. If they don't beat West Virginia, then they need BYU's to lose to Central Florida. For BYU, they are second in the conference, 10-1 overall, 7-1 in conference. Win. Beat UCF. And if you don't beat UCF, then you get in assuming Arizona State loses to Arizona due to tiebreakers with Utah and Houston. Third in the Big 12 is Arizona State. They are 3-1 overall, 6-2 in conference. Sorry, 8-3 overall. Man, I'm tired. 6-2 in conference. Arizona State needs to beat Arizona, and they need either Utah to beat Kansas and BYU to lose to UCF, or they need both Utah and BYU to lose due to tiebreakers, which means if Utah beats Kansas, then they need BYU to lose. But if Utah loses, then they absolutely have to have BYU lose as well to get in via tiebreakers. It's all very convoluted. Wouldn't this just be better if we had like a 4-team conference tournament before the 16-team college football playoff? Part of me thinks so, to be honest with you. I think it's going to be Texas Tech and BYU. That's kind of been the telegraphed outcome for the last like month and a half. Those two teams are just better. Texas Tech specifically is just really good this year. They got some linebacker. I forget his name, but he's so good. His name is like Rodriguez or something Rodriguez. Really good dude. Does it all, tackles, runs, interceptions. Really, you know, underrated guy. Okay. Next, let's talk about quick hits. Just some quick scores. So, number one, Ohio State defeated Rutgers 42-9. Ohio State continues to talk about how they slow the pace of their game down or whatever to kind of preserve it, but it was a methodical offensive performance from Ohio State. They were very injured on offense. So, like, wide receivers Carnell Tate and Jeremiah Smith, and I think their number four receiver were all injured. Their number six or seven wide receiver was being benched for, like, performance reasons. So, ultimately, it came down to tight end Max Clair had the majority of receptions against Rutgers, but it's Rutgers, so there was no danger. There's rumors that Jeremiah Smith and Carnell Tate could probably have gone. They probably could have played against Rutgers, but they wanted to keep them out for load management so they'd be healthy for the Michigan game, but we don't know for sure. All right, moving on. Number nine, Notre Dame absolutely smacked Syracuse, winning with a score of 70-7. So Syracuse was playing a true freshman QB and not some like high-ranking hot shot true freshman, like some guy I'd never even heard of. And this poor kid, oh my God, he threw like three or four interceptions and he was just a calamity. But it was one of those where it's like, makes a mistake, but the mistake was overturned because of a penalty, so he has to go out there and continue playing, makes another mistake that's even worse than the previous one, and then Notre Dame scores. And then he gets the ball back and it's another mistake, and just piling on. He was out of his depth. He just was. Multiple interceptions, fumbles, sacks, just the whole gamut of all of it. It was I felt bad for the guy. Like I was watching the game to avoid spoilers because I was going to be watching the Michigan game on a delay. So the only game I could think of that wouldn't spoil the outcome of the Michigan game was the Notre Dame game. So I'm sitting there watching this game and I'm like, God damn, can we get like a mercy rule like high school? Can we like get running clock so we can run this thing out? Like 70-7 is the most lopsided game I've seen between two Power 4 teams since probably 2016 when Michigan beat Rutgers like 77-0 or whatever in, you know, that game against Chris Ash where he got, you know, they fired him not long after. That game was so bad against Rutgers. They were like digging up people on the depth chart you'd never even heard of. This game was very similar. I'd never even heard of half the guys Notre Dame was playing. Number three, Texas A&M. They had a cupcake game against Samford. They won 48-0. Yawn. Moving on. Number 11, BYU defeated Cincinnati 26-14. So this eliminated Cincinnati from Big 12 title contention and makes BYU just one win away. I didn't watch this game, to be completely honest with you. I just saw the box score. But it was a relevant game because Cincinnati was still a dark horse Big 12 title game contender, assuming they beat BYU and had some other breaks go their way. So this game was important. And then the last of the quick hits, before we talk about what's going on next week, number 20, Tennessee beat Florida 31-11. The reason this game is even at all relevant is because this was the first time Tennessee has won against Florida in the swamp in Gainesville since 2003. 22 straight years without a win in the Swamp, which I know how that feels because Michigan, before 2021, Michigan hadn't won in the Horseshoe since I was 6. No. Yeah, since I was like 6 years old. I'm almost 30. So like it had been a long, long, long time. So I'm happy for Volunteers fans. I know the season didn't really go how they wanted to, you know, but getting that monkey off your back is great, and you got to beat your hated rival in Florida, which is always fun. All right, next week, so Miami at Pitt. I think the weather is going to have a really big deciding factor in this game. I think Pitt's going to win 24-21. But man, Pat Narduzzi. If Pat Narduzzi can get his team into the ACC championship game, after some of the discourse we were seeing from Pitt fans in the middle of the season about, like, should we fire him? Is he the right guy? We're stagnating. We're not going in the right direction. After all of that, to see where Pitt has gone from there, it's very impressive. All right, Georgia versus Georgia Tech, the game that's known as clean old fashioned hate. So this game is being played. I think it's being played in like Mercedes-Benz Stadium or whatever. Or I think it's a neutral site this year. I can't remember, to be honest with you. I think Georgia's going to win 37-16. With Georgia Tech basically being eliminated from ACC title contention, I don't think they're going to be as motivated because there's no playoff berth on the line. There's no incentive to really put in an effort other than the rival. So I think it'll be kind of a letdown game for them after losing to Pitt, and I think they'll lose 37-16. All right, the next game up is the Egg Bowl. Ole Miss versus Mississippi State. This game, because of all of the Lane Kiffin stuff, I think this game is going to be very close. This Mississippi State team is bad. Like, don't get it twisted. They are bad, bad. But Lane Kiffin has been flirting with other teams for the last week and a half, and part of me thinks there's going to be distractions there, and I think a letdown is entirely possible, and I'm actually predicting that Mississippi State is going to defeat Ole Miss 31-30. And immediately after that, Lane Kiffin is going to announce that he's leaving for LSU. And there's a scenario where the playoff committee leaves Ole Miss out, because there's in the bylaws that, you know, they can leave teams out if they miss a key player or a key coach. So that's a scenario that I think can totally happen. I have Mississippi State winning that game 31-30 in one of those old-fashioned rivalry upsets. Excuse me. Next, Texas A&M has taken on Texas for the first time since A&M left for the SEC. Texas A&M is just better. They're just better everywhere. Mike Elko's a great coach. That defense is nasty. Marcel Reed is way better than Arch Manning. They've got good skill players. They got a tenacious offensive line. They don't make a lot of mistakes. They run the ball well. They control the pace of the game. And I have the Aggies beating the Longhorns 26-16, which is going to be great for Aggie fans because they've been wanting a piece of Texas for years. All right, next you got the Iron Bowl. Alabama is taking on Auburn, and they're taking on Auburn at Auburn this year. So, you know, there's all that kind of crazy voodoo. All Bama's got to do to get into the SEC championship game is win. But crazy things happen. And this game is going to be close, but at the end of the day, I have Bama winning 27-20 against a demoralized, head coachless Auburn team. And last but certainly not least, you've got the game, Michigan versus Ohio State. I'm doing a little more in-depth of a preview and prediction on this one. I'm going to talk about injuries, key players, key matchups, and then I'll make my prediction. So right off the top, Ohio State is favored by 11.5 points. The over-under on the game is 44.5 total points. If it was me, I don't think either team is going to cover the spread. like my gut says that I don't think either team is really going to cover the spread, and I would be shocked if the over is like really in danger. That being said, crazier shit has happened. Like, I didn't predict Michigan was going to absolutely dominate in 2021, you know, whatever. So there are some key injuries to talk about. To be completely honest and fair to Ohio State fans, I am not a Buckeye fan, so I did my best to decipher which Ohio State players, other than Carnell Tate and Jeremiah Smith, were like key players that are injured. But I just couldn't figure it out, and I couldn't get any answers on if any of the other guys were important. So the only ones I'm listing are Carnell Tate, who has missed three straight games now with an injury, and Jeremiah Smith. And there are rumors that Jeremiah Smith could have gone against Rutgers, and then, you know, it's not much an injury as much as like a lingering pain kind of thing. But he didn't play against Rutgers, and I think both of these guys are going to go. At least Jeremiah Smith, I think, is going to go against Michigan. Now, if these two are not playing, which I do not for a second believe, if neither of these guys is playing, Ohio State, their offense will be in a little bit of trouble. Because as we saw with Rutgers, the offense was different without their best wide receivers, as is every offense, you know? So it's those are two guys to really keep track of on the injury list during this week as we head into the game, because I think we will probably get an indication around Thursday, probably, but considering it's Monday, we don't know that kind of stuff yet. On the Michigan side, Justice Haynes is obviously out with a season ender. That's really disappointing because he was on a tear. And considering what this Michigan O-line has become, I genuinely believe that if Justice Haynes had been healthy for the Ohio State game, he could have gotten 200 yards rushing. With his explosive ability and how well the offensive lineman has been executing as of late, that combo, I think, could have been really deadly, but he's out. And Jordan Marshall left the Northwestern game with a shoulder injury, and they say he probably could have played against Maryland, but he didn't. I think he's more than likely going to get at least half of the rushing attempts for the team against Ohio State, just because we need him and just plain up need him. Now, the next injury I got to talk about, I mentioned before, Max Bredesen. We're not going to get him for Ohio State, and that's devastating because we love this, like, A-gap dive, like, play behind a fullback. Michigan runs it constantly. Like, if they get a third down conversion, they'll like, get to the line real quick and run this, like, A-gap dive play really fast. They do it over and over and over. If you watch Michigan tape, you'll see it where they're, like, in the shotgun, then Bredesen will run across the formation and then stop and come back, and as he's coming back, they'll, like, snap it and hand it the ball to the running back, who will then, like, follow behind Bredesen. So we're going to have a different fullback other than Max Bredesen, which he's the team captain, so he'll be there, but his presence will be missed. Other key players. So for Ohio State, the key players I kind of singled out are obviously starting quarterback Julian Sand. He's the most accurate QB in college football. He's hyper-efficient, but he hasn't had to play a game where it's like, bro, you need to win the game. Like, it's up to you. Every game has been kind of smooth sailing, you know? So he is going to be massive for Ohio State. If he has a bad game, they will lose. If he has an okay game, they probably can still lose. If he has a great game, they'll win. Yeah. With how effective he has been, if he has a great game, they'll win. Next, obviously, Jeremiah Smith, if he plays. I mean, that's duh. But even if he's not 100%, he's the kind of guy that you have to dedicate resources to because he's so explosive and he's so talented and he has such a good catch radius. So, Jeremiah Smith, obviously. The next one, tight end Max Clair. So this dude has really kind of come into his own down the stretch this season. He had 11 catches. It was either 11 catches or 11 targets against Rutgers. Huge day for him. I think even more than the Rutgers other than Jeremiah Smith, you could argue that if Max Clair really goes off, a lot of seam routes and stuff like that, it'll be really hard for Michigan to overcome that, because a big physical tight end dominating is really hard for a young team to defend, and Michigan is very, very young. More on that later. And the last player I'm going to single out for Ohio State is Caleb Downs. Now, some might recognize this name. He played for Alabama in 2013 before transferring last season to Ohio State. He is arguably the best defensive player in the country. If he doesn't win the Bronco Nagurski Award, I'll be shocked. This dude is one heck of a safety. He's so good. He should be a top 10 pick in April, but he probably won't be because other teams have bigger needs. But he is a top 10 talent, S tier. You can't miss on him. He's that good. He's a do everything. You know, there were those making an argument that he should have been in Heisman contention for how well he is playing at safety for Ohio State this year in Matt Patricia's defense. So Caleb Downs, man, you got to watch out for him at safety. He is a game changer. All right, now for Michigan's key players, obviously you got Bryce Underwood. The true freshman is doing his first Michigan Ohio State game, but as a guy who grew up like 15 miles from Michigan State, from the University of Michigan, he understands the rivalry. Either way, if he goes off, Michigan, here's what I'll say. If Bryce Underwood has like 250 yards and two touchdowns, I think Michigan will probably win rather easily. I think the game, because I don't expect him to do that nearly that well in this game, eat, win or lose. If he has that kind of game, I think Michigan will have found incredible success on the ground to go with it, because they're going to have to dedicate resources to the ground, to defending Michigan's ground game. So if he's getting that kind of production, like 250 yards and like multiple touchdowns, sky's the limit. All right, next is Bryson Cuzdahl, third string running back. Even if Jordan Marshall is healthy, I think Bryson Cuzdahl is going to be a vital contributor, because you can't run Jordan Marshall every time. This is a game where Michigan is going to run the ball and run the ball and run the ball, because it is supposed to be like right around freezing and possibly even snowing, hoping for snow. Snow games are always awesome. Here's hoping for a cold, snowy Ohio State game. Those are always cool. You don't get to see those. We haven't had one of those since 2021. And even then, before then, it had been years. So here's hoping for some snow. But in those kind of games, you run the ball a lot. So you're going to need Bryson Cuzdahl to be effective alongside Marshall, because we don't have any other depth, really. Next, you got defensive back Zeke Berry. So it's no secret that we don't have Mikey Sainer still, and we don't have, you know, all those guys we had in 23. So if anyone is going to contain Jeremiah Smith, it's Zeke Berry. It's got to be him. It's got to be you, dude. And he's a guy who can, I think he can do it. I think he did it last year. So if he plays well and we can limit the Ohio State passing attack, then I think sky's the limit. And the last key player to single out for Michigan is Dominic Zavada. Last year, he was the best kicker in the country. This year, he is yipped up, and he missed one on Saturday. He missed two kicks against Northwestern. He's missed like five kicks this year. It's crazy, because he was rock solid consistent last year. He was the best. And I think Dominic Zavada is probably going to have to make three or more field goals for Michigan to win the game. So if he has a bad game, then I think there's no chance Michigan wins. Because I just don't anticipate Michigan scoring four touchdowns, five. I just don't think that's a possibility. If Michigan wins, it's going to be like scored a touchdown or two touchdowns and kicked like three field goals, four field goals. So that's, Dominic Zavada is definitely going to be someone to, you know, hopefully, fingers crossed, he plays well. Key matchups. Obviously, can Michigan's defense repeat last year's masterclass performance? Last year, Wink Martindale called basically a perfect game, held Ohio State's vaunted offense to 10 points, smothered them. They had like less than 100 yards rushing, and their passing attack just never really got in rhythm. They were constantly getting at Will Howard. They forced a turnover or two. So if Michigan can Michigan do that again this year with a team that doesn't have Mason Graham and doesn't have all those rotational guys, you know, Derek Moore and some of them. So without those kind of guys, I think Derek Moore's gone. I can't remember. I'm really tired, to be honest with you. My memory is shot to hell. Either way, can Michigan's defense do it again? Because if Michigan can give even 80% of last year's performance with the upgrades to Michigan's offense in 2025, I think Michigan can win the game. You know, Michigan won last year with 67 yards passing and multiple turnovers. If Michigan can eliminate the turnovers and get like 150 yards passing and like 200 on the ground, they can win the game. It'll be ugly and stressful as hell, but they can win that game. The next key matchup, can Ohio State's defense contain Michigan's run game? I think the team that plays the best on defense is going to win the game. More than the offenses. If Michigan can run the ball, considering Ohio State's lack of rushing consistency against quality defenses, they just don't have a great running game. So if Michigan can run the ball, I don't know how. I mean, Ohio State will be in trouble. You know, so can Ohio State's defense contain by far the most prolific rushing attack they've played? Now, what helps Ohio State is the fact that there's no Justice Haynes, no Max Bredesen. Michigan has been down a couple alignment, even though we're kind of gelling at the moment. So, but either way, if they can do it, they'll win. If they can't do it, then Michigan will win. That's it, straight up. Because the team that runs the ball better almost always wins the Ohio State-Michigan game. And what I think is the most important matchup, which team can best limit turnovers and negative plays? If you get two turnovers and you miss a couple field goals, you lose. That was the difference last year. Ohio State turned the ball over a couple times and missed two field goals. Excuse me, my voice is killing me. All right, let's try that again. Anyway, so if you can run the ball and limit mistakes, you can win a low-scoring game. I don't think there's going to be a lot of scoring in this game. Having said all of that, all week I was like, oh yeah, I think Michigan's going to win this game. I was super confident. And then I started writing this write-up, and I started really digging into the matchups and the injuries and, you know, the stats and everything and where all these teams match up and all these things. And as much as I was really confident Saturday after the Michigan game, which was probably just rose-tinted glasses, I am predicting that Ohio State is going to win 26-16. I think it's going to come down to Bryce Underwood is going to make one really bad freshman mistake. Probably what's going to be, he's going to be rock solid, got like 150 yards passing in the first half. And then right before halftime, he's going to throw a pick six or something. And he won't be the same after that. And Michigan's offense will kind of sputter. And they'll pull away late. We've seen that kind of thing before. So I think 26-16 Ohio State. That's my prediction for the game this year. There was my stop being a homer and take off your rose-tinted glasses take. So 26-16. Either way, we'll be right here to recap all of it and look forward to conference championships and the playoff bracketology as it is. So I just finished recording and I forgot that I wanted to add an extra segment for the Michigan fans out there. So I'm coming back to record this small extra segment. So considering Michigan isn't really a lock for the playoffs, even if Michigan wins against Ohio State, so I came up with a Michigan playoff bid rooting guide. Assuming Michigan beats Ohio State on Saturday, the following results would help Michigan make it into the playoffs. So I'm going to tell you why each result and why I think it would help Michigan get into the playoffs. So Ole Miss needs to beat Mississippi State. And the reason is I think it reduces variables by locking in a guaranteed contender. There's less contention. Georgia needs to beat Georgia Tech. because it, once again, it reduces variables by locking in a guaranteed contender. Same thing with Texas A&M over Texas. If you can lock those three in, then there's less like, oh, but what about Texas? And what, you know, what about this extra team? Blah, blah, blah. It cuts all of that out for those three teams. Now, Michigan needs Washington to defeat Oregon. Because if Washington defeats Oregon, Oregon is in serious playoff trouble, and it really helps Michigan get to the Big Ten championship game. And even if Michigan doesn't win the Big Ten championship, going and having beaten Ohio State likely gets Michigan into the playoffs. But there's more. There's more. So these next two, I'm considering a package deal. So if one happens, then the next thing would also be good. So if, say, West Virginia beats Texas Tech, it would be good if UCF would also beat BYU. And the reason is because if those two teams would lose on Saturday together, it might prevent the Big Ten, the Big 12 runner-up from making it if one or both lose on Saturday, because they might have too many losses. And the committee said, well, they lost to UCF and they lost to West Virginia. So, you know, they lost this game and they lost the, you know, the Big 12 championship game. So, it, yes, it adds variability, but it actually might hurt one of their resumes enough to keep one of them out, because right now, I think they both make it. So, yeah. LSU over Oklahoma. If Oklahoma loses to LSU, they're not going to the playoffs. Even though they got a win over Michigan and they've gotten, you know, they beat Texas and they're in the SEC, if LSU beats Oklahoma, Oklahoma is eliminated. So, from that same vein, we need Texas to beat Vanderbilt. Not Texas, Tennessee to beat Vanderbilt, because it eliminates Vandy from having the most outside of outside shots at making the playoffs. Getting further into it, though, Michigan needs Auburn to defeat Alabama, because it would either eliminate or greatly diminish Alabama's chances of getting in. They're likely getting in anyway, because they got four ranked wins, including one over Georgia. But losing to Florida State and Auburn, yeah, you might not make it. And if you do, Michigan might get bumped up ahead of Alabama anyway, just because, well, yeah, they beat Ohio State. They're the youngest team in the country, yet they're still 10-2. Blah 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 blah. So it might help Michigan, because right now, even if Michigan was to get in, they'd probably get in as like the 11th seed anyway. And lastly, and this one is the big one, Michigan needs Stanford to beat Notre Dame, which isn't going to happen. But if the Cardinal can beat Notre Dame, then Notre Dame is eliminated. They're gone. They'd have three losses, including they'd have losses to Texas A&M, Miami, and Stanford, which, yes, two of those are pretty solid teams, but Stanford is bad. So if the Cardinal win, then Notre Dame is done, and everything else I just mentioned doesn't even matter. Because if Notre Dame is eliminated, then Michigan likely gets in if they beat Ohio State. Like, none of it else matters. But, so yeah. So those teams are, so these are the teams that Michigan fans, in my opinion, should be rooting for on Rivalry Week. Ole Miss, Georgia, Texas A&M, Washington, West Virginia, UCF, LSU, Tennessee, Auburn, Stanford. I hope all of those teams win. I hope Michigan beats Ohio State so we can all get in the playoffs. And who knows, maybe Michigan and Ohio State can rematch in the playoffs. How freaking sick would that be? Getting a neutral site rematch like a couple of weeks after the game. I think it'd be awesome. For those of you listening on Apple Podcasts and everywhere else that podcasts are available, thank you, thank you, thank you. Please consider, you know, subscribing or following or leaving a like or a review or tell your friends and family about the podcast. For those of you watching on YouTube, like, comment, subscribe, hit the bell icon so you get all notifications of new episodes. Commenting is great because it feeds the algorithm and helps us reach more people. My name is H. James K. Thank y'all for tuning in. Until next time.